What would you do if tomorrow the cities of Livermore and Tracy and Pleasanton and Dublin and San Ramon, I think that covers our people, and Mountain House, it's between Livermore and, yeah, there we go, announced a 10-year combined effort to transform every single intersection from a protected stop with stop signs and lights to roundabouts. You excited about it? I'm not sure if everybody knows what a roundabout is. I see some heads shaking. No roundabouts. roundabouts, you come up, it's a big circle, you merge in, you merge out, and there's no lights or anything. It's a thing. This morning, roundabouts are going to be our case study in wisdom. Wisdom is what God gives us to live well in this world. To help us rightly order the domains that God has put us in charge of. Wisdom is what helps us care for the gardens that we have been given, the gardens of our lives. If wisdom is about living well and bringing order to our domains, then wisdom, it involves every single part of our lives. And you heard me say this last week, it involves the technology that we use. It involves the media that we enjoy, the social media sites we post on and scroll through, the news that we consume. Wisdom involves our friendships and our families and our romantic relationships. It involves our money and our homes and our cars and all of the rest of our stuff. Wisdom involves who we marry and why. Wisdom involves our careers, our hobbies, our habits, and even our vices. So wisdom also then involves the social and the civic policies we support and promote. If you've read through the book of Proverbs, you won't be surprised by any of this. Proverbs is concerned with all of this stuff, and it deals with almost all of it in various ways. And as boring or uninteresting as traffic policy might sound to you, cars just continue to be a significant cause of death and injury. And it turns out, as uninterested as we are in something like traffic policy, people become very interested when their city announces an increase in roundabouts. If you are like the average American, you would strongly oppose any plan to transform protected intersections into roundabouts. It's been seen throughout the country that when cities make these sorts of proposals, citizens often rise up in passionate protest. People who don't care about most other things most of the rest of the time care a lot about losing intersections and getting roundabouts. And as far as surveys can gather, it's rarely because of like the financial cost of this kind of transition. It is primarily because roundabouts are unfamiliar and uncomfortable to most Americans. It cracked me up last year when Tom and Jeannie got back from Europe. Tom was telling me about Ireland as part of their trip, and he had decided to drive, which in Ireland is on the opposite side of the road. And he describes getting into their rental car and then going to leave the airport, where right as you leave the airport, there is a giant roundabout. And so he joked that about it being like trial by fire for American drivers. Like, not only do you jump into the car on the wrong side of the road immediately, but then you have to do it while navigating an unfamiliar roundabout. It was then fun having heard him talk about this when I went to Ireland a few months ago, or a few months later, and got to experience that exact roundabout for myself. And I wasn't driving, and I was nervous. Like, which way are we going? Don't know how to do this. Americans are mostly unfamiliar with roundabouts, and they make us uncomfortable when we're unfamiliar with them. And yet, the data seems to show that roundabouts significantly decrease the number of injury crashes that occur. So, like, one study revealed that everywhere a protected intersection had been replaced by a roundabout, the number of injury crashes went down by 75%, which is significant. And there are some obvious reasons for this decline. With the roundabout, you no longer have cars gunning it to make a light before it turns red. Just to use a roundabout, as you come up to this thing, you have to slow down in order to get into it. And you also eliminate the geometry that allows for head-on collisions. When I started riding a motorcycle in high school, I had to take this like safety class that everyone has to take if they're under 21. And they taught us that in this class, that intersections are the most dangerous place to ride. But the sheer number of ways you can get hit at an intersection is just mind-blowing. So think about this. Americans largely hate a thing that they know very little about and have minimal contact with, yet have proven to be safer for us. Even when Americans are presented with this data, we continue to oppose roundabouts. Until, and this is where it gets interesting, there are some communities in the United States that are pro-roundabout for a variety of reasons. Their city leaders were able to get roundabouts installed throughout the city. And now there are now a few American cities with a substantial number of them. And over time, in these places where people have experienced roundabouts firsthand and become proficient in navigating them, the opposition to them just disappears. So what this tells us is that opposition is based in people's unfamiliarity with roundabouts and their own personal discomfort in navigating them. So let me just summarize this, and then as we move into our text and how these things are connected, the data suggests roundabouts are a wise alternative to protected intersections. But we resist this wisdom because roundabouts make us nervous. They're unfamiliar, and we don't know how to comfortably navigate them. Telling people how dangerous intersections are doesn't fix the problem. People don't change their minds, and we just become more committed to the intersections we already know, especially when somebody starts threatening a roundabout on us. It's only when people are basically forced to experience roundabouts, required to drive them, that they have the chance to learn them and be comfortable navigating them. It's in this acquired comfort that their attitude towards them changes. So I think this is a fascinating case study because it represents perfectly, so perfectly, our need for wisdom, right? In so many areas of our lives, like, we're just living as we always have. Our lives often lack righteousness and lack justice and lack equity because our lives lack wisdom. I think this case study also represents our resistance to wisdom. Right? We can be offered a better way, a more wise way, but we are experts. We have so many ways to rationalize and justify our paths. The paths that we like, that are well-worn, that are so comfortable, that we often reject the very wisdom that would make life better, not only for us, but for those that are in our care. And I also think this case study represents well the process through which we attain wisdom. Proverbs tells us that to be wise, we need to experience wisdom. We need to practice it. And we need the discipline of wisdom so that wisdom becomes second nature in us. So like wisdom isn't just knowing a bunch of facts about roundabouts and telling people, yeah, roundabouts are a great idea. Wisdom is knowing the heart of God. Wisdom is longing for God's justice. And it is instinctively then looking for ways to keep us from killing each other. When we find wisdom, then we can't help but then begin to discipline our lives in uncomfortable ways. Jesus would call this denying ourselves, taking up our crosses and following him, all for the sake of others. You could find a parallel in texting while driving, right? It's one thing to know that it's dangerous to text and drive, but it is wisdom that calls us to love God enough with our lives and our actions, to love our neighbors enough with our lives and our actions, to practice the discipline of not texting while we drive. So this case study offers us some insights about wisdom, but also it this study seems to illustrate, I think, some of the unique things Proverbs tells us about what wisdom is and why we need it. Our passage this morning is the introduction for all of the book of Proverbs, in many ways for the wisdom literature. And I'd like for us to hear it again. And I'll read it from the English Standard Version. I mean, we heard it from the Common English Bible, which is our congregational set. But you'll hear that some of the words are translated differently, and this points us to some of the challenges in interpreting some of these words. But if you would open, if you have your Bibles, Proverbs chapter 1. So we hear the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. We're reminded that in Genesis, we were made to rule over the earth. And so here is the wisdom of a king passing these words on to his son. I should say that as we read most of Proverbs, most of them don't have to do with actually ruling, but how to live well in family and in community. So the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, to know. What an interesting word. It's a different word than different than the way that we tend to use word know. Like, I know a bunch of facts, but you can't simply know a bunch of facts. Know is an experiential kind of knowing. John Golden Gay, Old Testament scholar, talks about getting pulled over by the police. Driving a car and the police saying to you, do you know the speed limit? Or do you know why I pulled you over? Which would be a weird question to somebody who understands no in this way. Because if he says, yes, I knew that I was speeding. No, you didn't, because you were speeding. You didn't know because you weren't doing it. So to know, to live, to experience wisdom and instruction. This is the Hebrew word for discipline. Not discipline in terms of punishment, discipline in terms of what an athlete does to their body to be the very best athlete that they can be. Discipline. To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction or discipline and wise dealing in righteousness, justice, and equity, that wisdom would result in lives that are righteous and just and that pursue equity, to give prudence to the simple. This word prudence is the same word from Genesis 3. We discover a serpent who is crafty, that the young would be crafty. Although crafty has, there's sort of two different ways it can go. One is a positive way in God's sort of work and favor, and the other is to oppose what God is doing. To give prudence, craftiness to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance to understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. Think about the disciples following Jesus, hearing Jesus speak in proverbs and parables, wisdom words, and sometimes riddles. They didn't understand what he was saying. And so he invited them to come, to keep learning from him. Verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. 7 short verses that tell us what this book is for and where to start. These 7 verses, they also tell us who this book is for. And we're given 3 categories of people, 3 categories of people that exist. In verse 4, we're introduced to the simple. In the next line, they are referred to as the youth or the young. One way to think about this group is that they are people who lack wisdom because they're still immature. And some of them are immature because they're young and simply haven't had the chance to grow up yet. And so this is in no ways a derogatory description. It's just a description of where they're at in their place in life. But some are immature because they have never grown up for any number of reasons. But this is different from the other kind of unwise person found in the book of Proverbs. We find this person in the very last line of this introduction. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. We learn about the fool. As we read on in Proverbs, we're actually going to learn that there are more than one kind of fool. There's the blind fool. They don't know what they don't know, and they don't care that they don't know, and they assume that they're wise and can't be convinced otherwise. And then there's the hostile fool. These are commonly referred to as the scoffers or the mockers. They trust in the wisdom of their own eyes and their own experience more than anything else, and they reject the idea that they should have to learn from anyone else, especially from God. And so whether blind or hostile, you can see how this last line of verse 7 applies. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Whether they think that they are already wise or they think that they're smarter than anything God might provide, they resist wisdom and instruction and in fact despise it. And for these reasons, the book of Proverbs isn't for the fool. That might sound harsh, but Jesus said, don't cast your pearls before swine. Verse 2 tells us that this book is here to help people know wisdom and instruction, which means this book would do nothing for a blind fool or a hostile fool. It would be worthless to them. They're only interested in doing what seems right in their own eyes. They would ignore or despise anything in this book. Blind fools and hostile fools, hopefully, thinking of these kinds of fools, maybe you can hear some of our attitudes and our approaches to roundabouts or to whatever else might replace the question of roundabouts or the issue in your life. That we are comfortable in our experience. We don't want to be told that there is a better way. We trust the way intersections have always been done, which makes us incapable of hearing wisdom. Let this be a warning to us that we may not be as wise as we'd like to believe. Or at least there may be parts of our lives where we are biased against wisdom. Which brings us to the third category of people from our passage. And we've already met the simple or the young. They are unwise, and so they need the book of Proverbs to help them know wisdom. And we've met the blind and the hostile fools, and they are unwise, but they would rather use the book of Proverbs as like toilet paper or something. Well, our third group appears in verse 5, and they are the wise, also referred to as those who understand. And here we learn an important element of wisdom. Wisdom never ends. You don't become wise and then like settle in, like get a wise chair where you sit there and you never like need any more wisdom ever along because you're like perfectly wise. There's no such thing as perfectly wise. Wisdom is not about an arrival. See, once you are wise, you demonstrate your wisdom by continuing to increase in learning, continuing to seek guidance, continuing to grow and mature. There's a paradox built into being wise. The wiser you are, the less wise you feel, because you know just how unwise you are, how much more wisdom of God there is to find. And so you discover that those who are wise will rarely identify themselves as such. And so it's often been the task of the community of faith, the people of God, to identify the wise in our midst, to say these are the people who we need to follow and listen to closely. But for the wise, we recognize that the moment you stop learning and growing is really the moment that you have reverted back to unwise. Now, hopefully, if you have found yourself in this place, you've simply adopted the attitude of the simple or immature, but the wise have been known to just stop seeking wisdom because they have become wise in their own eyes. And we think a little bit of Solomon from last week, where having been wise, we find ourselves blind or hostile to the need for any more of God's wisdom. The already wise need the book of Proverbs just as much as the unwise do. Okay, so Proverbs has has introduced us to the book by connecting us with three different kinds of people: the simple or young person, the wise or understanding person, and the fool. And so I ask you this question. You read this question this week and hopefully considered it a bit using the daily worship guide. Do you know which of these you are? It's a really hard question to answer. Because fools are rarely going to self-identify as such. I already told you that the wise are going to have a hard time declaring their wisdom. Since the wise and the unwise are these fairly like black and white set of categories, they can feel pretty static too. Like sometimes, maybe based on the issue, we move between them. But I would love for you this morning to think on like a 10-point scale. So not just wise, not just unwise. But where might you fall on this scale of wisdom? It's important to point out that the fool actually doesn't have a place on the scale, right? Either blind or hostile, like they wouldn't be on the scale at all. But if that's you, like if you find yourself going, I have no interest in God's wisdom, it's important to just note that, name that. But on the scale, sort of thinking about it, 1 to 10, 1 to 3 is like simple or young. And it's important to just recognize any new follower of Jesus, any person who's starting to walk with Jesus would fall here. Anyone who hasn't read much of the Bible yet would fall here. This is the starting place for us all, right? And so Proverbs doesn't talk about the simple or the young, again, in derogatory terms. It's just the starting point. But this is also the place where many people wind up after years and years of going to church. Because they never took responsibility for their own spiritual growth. And were just content to stay immature, young, simple. And so it's not about the amount of time that you've spent in the faith that determines where you would fall in this. But then if you were to think like 4 to 6, so kind of the middle transition place, you know, if you were in this place, you probably shouldn't be teaching anyone yet, but you're learning. You're learning to practice your faith and are having some small successes at living wisely in the world. Probably some people around you are affirming some wise decisions that you've been making. You've begun making decisions like with others seeking counsel. 7 to 10 would be wise. Clearly, there's no perfection in 7 to 10. You must still be learning and growing, but God has qualified you to teach, and the body of Christ is confirming that. The Holy Spirit has made you capable of serving as an elder or an overseer of the church. And again, this is being confirmed. As I spent the week thinking about these categories, I thought quite a bit about our brother Don. It's interesting because many would have considered Don a fairly simple man with simple faith. You could probably count the number of books that he's read outside of the Bible on a single hand. And yet, if you opened his Bible, which I got to spend some time with this last week, you will see evidence that his hands have been all over that thing. The pages aren't simply ruffled from being turned, but they are stained with the oils of his hands. Passages marked and starred and underlined and double underlined again and again, notes throughout the margins. Don received that Bible in December 1982, which means he started poring over its pages the year that I was born. Don was so incredibly hungry for God's wisdom. As a young preacher, I actually struggled to not be intimidated by Don. Like, if you can imagine being intimidated by Don, I was. See, because by the time he would get here to worship on any given Sunday morning, he had already heard 2, if not 3 sermons. But this is what made Don's pursuit of wisdom so beautiful. This 80-year-old man, listening to widely respected preachers, most of them twice my age, he could then come into worship and he could submit his heart and his mind and his life to the teaching of some 30-year-old. Because Don was so hungry to hear about God's ways. He so wanted to figure out how to walk in them. If that meant listening to 3 great sermons and then some young punk, he was glad to glean whatever he could of God, and he would do it. But of course, see, Don was never listening to sermons with an empty mind or a blank slate. Don's imagination had been so powerfully shaped by the gospel and the scriptures that he was able to critically discern whether what he was listening to was true wisdom from God or something else. And he had this amazing ability to come alongside me through the years, helping ease my intimidation and just affirming that was so clearly from God. Those were incredible moments. And it's interesting, going back to my opening case study, that we can't know what Don would think about roundabouts. I don't care what Don would think about roundabouts, because that's not important right now. But you know what I do know? I do know what Don would do when confronted by something new and uncomfortable and unfamiliar. Because almost 10 years ago, as a church, we decided to start a second service, to have a service, a worship service that met on Saturday nights. And I was going to lead that. Our lead pastor was going to lead on Sunday mornings. And our leadership felt like this was a good idea. We had a strong sense of why we were doing this. And we sent out a letter to the church. And Don reached out to me. He said, I got this letter and I would love to talk to you. And so we came down and we walked over to Starbucks. And he just walked through this letter and he shared, I'm worried. I'm worried that this might divide our church, that it could be an issue of division, that it could break apart unity. And we talked and we prayed together. And he got to hear a little bit of my heart for what I was hoping to do on Sunday nights or Saturday nights in terms of connecting some young adults, some young families. And he said, this is different. I don't know what to do with it, but hearing your heart, I'm certain that God is in it and you will see me before it, whatever that looks like. And that was so profoundly challenging to me. Again, he wasn't 80 yet, but so wanted to do God's will that he was able to listen and learn and keep growing and walking in wisdom. Such a gift to me. As an example, as a model for wisdom. But really, what Don does, more than give me an example here or a story there, it's really the heart of his life that brings us to the heart of our passage. See, in so many respects, figuring out where you fall on this scale of 1 to 10 in terms of unwise to wise is really about one thing. For Don, he had a simple yet deep, abiding trust in God, who was the beginning of everything. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7 tells us, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. See, there are two kinds of fear. When it comes to God, we see this all throughout the scriptures. Sometimes two different passages tell us things that sound like complete opposites, right? Fear God and do not be afraid. Which one would I do? See, there is the fear that sends us running from God, often into hiding, sometimes into a kind of maybe terrified obedience. Whatever it is we do with the fear, it's a fear that separates us from God. But there is also a kind of fear that sends us running to God. It is a deep sense of awe. It is a fear that trembles over how good God is. It is a fear that cannot imagine life apart from God. This is the fear that draws us near. See, going back 2 weeks ago, Adam and Eve, they wanted wisdom, but they wanted it without God. And when they grasped for it, they ran and they hid because they were terrified of what God might do to them now. But had they feared God in the beginning, then they would have waited patiently for him to come in the cool of the day. They would have brought their questions directly to him. They would have known God's love and grace all the more deeply, and they would have been ready to care for this garden. And so the question becomes, will we start with fear that draws us close to God? You didn't have to listen to Don very long to realize that this was the fear that motivated his life. Or will we pursue our own path and find fear as we wonder now what God might do to us? There's the fear of knowing that God is for us. And there is the fear of wondering if God is against us. The amazing thing is what happens for those who fear, who live in fear that maybe God is against them. Having followed their own wisdom, wondering what God might do to them, we should hear our own stories in this. To us, we find ourselves confronted by Jesus, the wisdom of God. 1 John, which we were in at the end of the year, tells us that perfect love casts out fear. For those who are living afraid of what God might do to them, they have to look no farther than Jesus to know what God intends to do. He gave his son in perfect love so that we might no longer hide in fear again. So that we might come with transformed fear and seek his wisdom as we were made to do. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We have in our brother Don an example of what a life lived with this kind of fear looks like. But there are others in our midst as well. I encourage you to think about where you might fall on that scale of 1 to 10. In truth, I don't think actually any of us could answer that question by ourselves, for ourselves. And so I just want to encourage you in your small groups with a board member, with me, to ask, where am I in this journey of wisdom? Because finding out where we are in this spectrum of unwise to wise will give us our marching orders. To some extent, where do I go next? What do I need to do to continue to let wisdom rule in my life so that I might rule well over the domains that God has put me in charge of? We continue to seek wisdom this morning by coming to the table, reminded that Jesus is the wisdom of God. And so to seek God's wisdom is to seek Jesus. As our servers come and get in their spots, I'll invite all of us to come to the table to receive the bread and the cup together, and then to return to our seats where we will receive.